I am speaking with Judith LeBlanc, who retired in 1997 as Professor of Human Development and, would you say?
And Special Education, and also the Associate Director for the Lifespan Institute for International Development.
At the University of Kansas. We're in Lawrence, Kansas on May 26th, 1998. Where were you born and in what year?
Beaumont, Texas, 1936.
What were your parents' names?
Eunice Estelle LeBlanc. Well, you want her maiden name?
That's all right.
Eunice Estelle Thompson, and now LeBlanc, and Clifford Harris LeBlanc.
What was their educational background?
They each, mother had 2 years of college, and dad had, I think, a year and a half.
What was your father's occupation?
He was an engineer, and then he became a draftsman for a company that he subsequently became president of.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
Mm-hmm. 2 brothers.
Were they older or younger?
Older, twins, five years older.
Oh, really? Did you grow up in Beaumont then?
Until I graduated from high school, yes.
What do you remember about Beaumont? Was it a very big town? I don't really know much about Texas.
Actually, it's about 90 miles northeast of Houston, almost in Louisiana.
Oh, really?
Yeah, about 20 miles from the Louisiana border, and about 20 miles from the Gulf Coast also. I remember going to high school mainly, isn't it?
Yeah. What elementary school did you attend?
Ogden Elementary School.
Were you in organizations like the Girl Scouts or Y?
Well, my mother took a group of 15 of us in the Campfire Girls and took us from Bluebird Age all the way through the Torchbearer of the highest rank. And we all received the Torchbearer at the same time. The interesting thing was I was a year younger than my grade group because I had skipped a grade.
Oh, uh-huh.
And so they had to wait until I was old enough to receive the awards. So it postponed it by a year. But
yeah.
She, all 15 wanted to do it at the same time. She was nationally recognized for that.
Uh-huh.
Mother worked a lot with young people.
Really? Did you, you went to camp, I suppose?
Oh yes, in the summertime.
And things
mm-hmm.
like that. Yeah. Did World War II affect you and your family?
Well, in one sense, but in a very minor sense relative to other people. I mean, you know, we had the usual rationings and those kinds of things, but we did a lot of war effort things in our service groups.
What sort of things did you do?
Oh, we would send packages to the boys overseas and that kind of thing.
Oh, uh-huh.
And collect things. We collected string and tinfoil, as I recall.
I wonder what they plan to do with string.
I have no idea.
That's an odd one. And you went to junior high, what junior high?
Or David Crockett Junior High School.
Uh-huh. And then high school in Beaumont also.
Mm-hmm. It was just called Beaumont High School. It was the only high school, except for one in a suburb, it was the only high school in the town.
What were your favorite classes?
Well, that's an interesting question I never really thought about. In high school?
Yeah.
Probably depended on the teacher, because I enjoyed biology, but I had a really good biology teacher, and I enjoyed drama, because I had a really good drama teacher, so I think it went by teachers more than by...
Mm-hmm. Were you in plays then, if you were in drama?
Yeah, I wasn't really that good though, so when the play went to state, I ended up being the person that did most of the makeup work and everything like that.
Did you have honors in high school?
Honors? No. In other words, I didn't graduate valedictorian or anything. We didn't have a lot of honors in our high school for anything other than, I was on the student council and I, ran for a couple of offices. I usually came in second because of the, I wouldn't run for the lower offices, I ran for the big ones. And I was editor of my yearbook.
Oh. Any other extracurricular activities?
I was in the orchestra, I played the cello, and I played the piano for 15 years.
Oh.
And voice for 8 years, because I also belong to a choral group. We sang for the military after the war, because of course there were still a lot of people in the military. We would go overseas and
oh, you went even in high school on overseas mm-hmm. trips to mm-hmm. do that. That must have been very interesting. You went to Europe,
fun,
I suppose?
Yeah. Yes, went to Europe. We went to a lot of different, went to New York when I was 12, that was my first trip, and then we went to Europe, Hawaii, Greenland, a variety of different places.
Why, there aren't very many high schools who do that kind of thing.
Well, the high school didn't do it. This was a private
organization. Just a private organization in town.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have to have a lot of fundraising and things then?
Well, it was up to, yes, to a certain degree, but the military actually paid for it.
I mean, in the sense
that they took us in military planes
to
entertain.
Yeah. Did you have summer jobs or jobs after school?
Yeah, I worked in my father's company in the summertime, mostly during college.
What did you do?
In the company, I did secretarial work. Uh-huh. I substituted for people who were going on vacation for what I did.
Was it always assumed that you would go to college?
I didn't realize that people didn't go to college until I got out of high school. So yes, I presume so. It was never discussed. It was just
assumed that you would go. Where did you go?
My undergraduate work was at Southern Methodist University.
And why did you choose that school?
Because it was an outstanding Texas school in music, and I majored in music my first year and a half.
Oh, I see. And then you switched to psychology mm-hmm. after that. Why did you decide not to major in music?
Well, I wasn't good enough to be a concert pianist, so I decided I didn't want to be a music teacher. Seeing students come in one after, or piano teachers, one after the other every 30 minutes. So I want something a little more active.
Yeah. Did you have influential teachers in your undergraduate years?
I liked the teachers in the School of Religion, so I ended up minoring in religion. The interesting thing about it was is that at Southern Methodist, they weren't necessarily teaching the Methodist religion. They were teaching history of religion, theory of religion, those kinds of things.
Uh-huh.
So I learned a lot about the various religions of the world.
Where was Southern Methodist?
It's in Dallas, Texas.
Oh, in Dallas, uh-huh. Did you, were you involved in extracurricular activities in college?
Extracurricular activities. Yeah, I was in some of the sports things. I did sports in high school too.
Oh,
swimming. And I taught swimming when I was, I guess my first time I taught was when I was 12. Because I had my junior life saving and they needed day camp teachers. So I started doing that early on. And I was involved in some of the sports and, you know, extracurricular type sports. In college, and of course the usual parties.
Yeah. Did you have honors in college?
No.
Did you work either in? You said you worked in the summer.
In the summertime.
Your father's company. And then when did you graduate?
That's a good question.
I
must have been 1957.
And then what did you do after graduation?
It was very interesting. I went to Houston and for a year I taught, I worked in a public relations office. And essentially, it was a very small office, and so I essentially did all of it. It was sort of a jack of all trades kind of position. And decided that I was not meant to be a glorified secretary, basically. So I quit, and Houston needed 50 teachers that year because they didn't have enough teachers. They had an influx of kids. And so they said anyone with a college degree come and apply, and I did. And because I had a psychology degree, they decided that I could teach special education. And so they wanted me to teach. I had already said I would never be a teacher, which was kind of interesting. And then I said they wanted me to teach kids with retardation. I said I would never do that. So they gave me the classes with the physically handicapped.
Oh.
Now my career, of course, ends up being highly focused on kids with severe retardation. But that's, never say never.
So you taught these physically handicapped. Was this an elementary school
mm-hmm.
situation?
Mm-hmm.
How did you find that? Did you find it difficult? You evidently hadn't had much training in this.
Well, no, the two things helped me. One was it was the fourth, fifth, and sixth grade.
Mm-hmm.
They gave me all the stack of curriculum manuals. And I only had 3 hours of education in my background at that point. Of course, I had to go back to school and to maintain the
yeah.
temporary certification. And then there were a couple of aides who had worked there for years who took care of the children's physical needs.
Uh-huh.
And one of them was, she's probably in her late 50s at that time. And so she basically, I was very friendly, and she told me about all the kids and how to handle them, because I had not seen that many kids with disabilities at that point.
What kind of disabilities did they have? Was it mostly like they couldn't walk, or they
mm-hmm.
couldn't?
It was physical, cerebral palsy, spina bifida, polio, because we still had the polio.
Yeah.
Mainly were the ones that we had.
So these children could learn then other than this, they just couldn't get
well,
around.
Well, it was interesting,
well.
The mix of kids was some could learn quite easily and others had a little bit of retardation. But they could learn, yes.
Mm-hmm. So how long did you do this job?
2 or 3 years. And then I decided once I got my certification, I needed to...
So you were going back to school like at night and
mm-hmm.
in the summer to
yeah,
what,
the
Southern...
University of Houston.
University
I was in Houston,
of Houston.
That time. And I was getting a certification in special education in regular ed. Then I decided to make my regular education certification good, that I needed to teach regular school too. I think I did that for a year or so.
What
and
grade
then
did you teach?
Sixth grade. And then I went to, I decided I needed some different things in my life, and I like to travel, so I looked into the teaching in the American military schools and took a job over in Germany for 3 years and taught there in their military school in Heidelberg, Germany.
What grade did you teach?
Sixth grade.
Oh, uh-huh. Did you have a chance to travel in Germany and Europe
yeah.
in the summers?
Traveled all over. Mm-hmm. Learned to ski there and traveled all over Greece, Yugoslavia, Italy, France, all of the countries.
Did you travel with other teachers
mm-hmm.
who were
mm-hmm.
in this program? And did you?
And my mother on occasion, she would come over and visit in the summertime, and we would go.
Yeah, that sounds like
travel.
A great job.
Didn't pay very much, but.
Well, I suppose. Were these military children different from the students you had taught in Houston?
In one sense, yes, because there were in that era, I'm not sure that would hold true in the schools today, but in that era, there were probably more who were children who were kind of on their own, latchkey kids, and not because their parents were working, but because the mothers frequently were alcoholics.
Oh, this was the military people.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, really?
And, well, you know, they didn't have any groups. And this was mainly not necessarily the officers, because the officers made enough money. We had the very, very good, and we had the very, very bad students. Because the parents who took advantage of this moving around in the world
uh-huh.
advantage did quite well, with their kids did quite well. But we had a lot of behavioral problems too, ones whose parents didn't take advantage of the opportunities and did take advantage of the opportunities of st- st- sticking around the clubs and that kind of thing.
Yeah. So then you did this for about 3 years, mm-hmm. and then what did you get?
Well, I decided I needed to get serious about life. And and so I came back and took off in my car and went across the United States looking for a job. And
Were you looking for a job as a teacher then?
Not necessarily. I was looking for any kind of job that might interest me. And I mean, I even applied for a job in Northern California for a position as a photographer for the sports group in the, for their the university, photographer for the university, because I also had done photography work. And he said he would hire me, except I couldn't go into the men's dorms, or men's locker rooms. Mm-hmm. And so but then I got all the way out to California, Northern California, and started back. I was visiting with friends along the way looking for jobs. Ended up in Colorado and ran out of money and found a temporary job. And that's what I ended up working with again. I fell into the job, which teaching a classroom of children that were essentially kicked out of special education because of their behavioral problems, the severe kids.
Oh, my.
And so I back into my field again of special education, more by happenstance than mm-hmm. anything else. It was the class was in the basement of a Mormon church. They had donated that space, and so in all the rejects from special ed, again, you couldn't do that today, but they were able to do that then, and so we took the worst of the lot. They were pretty good kids, actually. I didn't think they were all that bad.
But they just couldn't get along, even in the regular special mm-hmm. education classrooms.
Well, the teachers couldn't handle them.
Now, this was in what city in Colorado?
This was in Denver.
In Denver.
And then I, on my weekends, spent skiing and teaching skiing so I could afford to ski, because again, I was not making very much money. Just enough to pay my rent and keep the rest in my pocket, really. So,
yeah.
But I like to ski, so I volunteered to teach in return for when they had overloads for the regular teachers of skiing. And so I taught the little kids.
What did you like about teaching these rejects from special education?
Well, it's something that I've carried with me all along. I saw them as people. I
uh-huh.
didn't see them as problems. And we had one little kid who would run away. He was part Indian, but he's very smart, actually. He just had severe behavior problems. And he would end up sitting in, because we were in the basement, he would sit in the tree and watch us. So we knew he was there. Well, eventually, he trusted us enough that we could send him to the store, because we had to buy certain things. We had to do everything ourselves. We had a certain budget to live within, but it was
mm-hmm.
sponsored by the Crippled Children's Organization. They weren't crippled. Well, a couple of them had some problems, but it was sponsored by that.
Oh, this was not a public school setting then.
It was aided also by public school funds.
I see.
But the rights of people with handicaps had not come in at that time.
This would have been in the late 1950s or 60s?
Yes. 1960. When I left Europe in 64, and in 65 I was doing that until I got a call for doing a job from my ex-professor at the University of Houston, and he was moving to Kansas.
Oh.
To do a research project down in Parsons, Kansas. And he called and asked if I would like to be his coordinator of this research project, to which I agreed because he was offering me about 10 times more than I was making at the time.
Now, this was working again with special education, was it with children?
Parsons State Hospital for retardation, kids with retardation.
What was this project? What were you doing?
It was called the Cottage Demonstration Project, and one reason I liked it is because it was using fundamental techniques to work with kids in the real world and try to move them back into a more normal life as opposed to staying in institutions. One of the earlier projects to do that. So that, you know, we've since subsequently deinstitutionalized a lot of our institutions.
Yeah.
But this was well before that time.
So you were teaching them like housekeeping skills or?
And community skills and how to, you know, work in the homes, how to work in their, in the community environment if we could ever find them a job. We weren't too lucky in those days. We're much more fortunate now to be able to do those things. But.
What are the difficulties of working with populations of this kind? It must be frustrating at times.
Well, you can get bunged up a bit until you learn what you're doing. Some of them are physically dangerous.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. And you have to be, well, I have a theory about that. I have a theory is if you treat them like people, they will not harm you. But if you treat them like they're a problem, they will. If you try to push them around, they'll push right back. But then I do too if somebody pushes me around.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I don't see that as abnormal.
How
I prefer to talk to them, reason with them. People say, well, they don't understand. Well, I think they do. I mean, I really do believe that we're missing the boat in terms of giving these people their just due for, we label them as people with retardation, but that doesn't mean that they don't understand. They just have a different way of learning. I prefer to call them people with different abilities rather than disabilities.
Hmm. Now, you said it was a cottage project. Did you have them like in small home-like settings?
Yeah,
like
well,
group
actually
homes,
wasn't.
Or?
It was a three-story building, each floor, because it was old-time architecture. Each floor was like a cottage, yes.
So how long were you involved with that project?
2.5-3 years.
And then what did you do?
Well, I came here to go to school because the Department of Human Development then changed thanks to Frances Horowitz and Dick Schiefelbusch and started working toward a PhD project. I came here to get my PhD in that program, before there was a program.
Well, now, where did you get your master's then?
But while I was in Parsons, I went to Pittsburgh State College over in in Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh.
That's right. And actually, that was kind of interesting, too. They gave me credit for all but 9 hours of a master's degree because I had continually gone to the university. But they interviewed me and decided that I really did know most of what they would teach me in school, so I had to take 3 hours, I think it was statistics and a couple of other courses, and then do a thesis.
What was your thesis on?
On discrimination learning and problems that kids have when they're trying to learn. Basic discriminations in things like left-right orientation was what I was talking about, but I was really interested in kids that reversed letters.
Oh, uh-huh. Like learning
and
disabled was what they
right
would call
and it,
it yeah.
Well or dyslexia.
Dyslexia, yeah. And you got your master's then when?
I don't know. I don't keep these dates in my head. Um, 1966 it says here.
Mm-hmm. So then you said you had your master's and you decided to go to KU. They were just setting up a PhD program in human development.
Actually, I went there and I guess it must have been because, and I don't think the program started until 68. Fully accredited.
Yeah, but you were taking...
They were taking steps toward...
You were taking your classwork and, mm-hmm. and things like that. And your major was psychology?
Psychology and human development. It was a joint program between the two departments.
Do you remember influential teachers from that time?
Lots of them. Barbara Edsel, Don Baer, Mont Wolf, Todd Risley. They were all very famous nationally and internationally for their work in behavior analysis.
Who was your major professor?
Don Baer.
And what was your thesis for PhD?
My dissertation.
Your dissertation.
Well, it's called Continuous Reinforcement of Possible Behavior Modification Procedure for Decreasing Resistance to Extinction. The Department of Human Development is an applied department, but I had had, at this point, a lot of applied experience. I chose instead to go back into the rat lab to learn the basic skills of experimental work, too, so that I would be able to use that in my applied work later, that knowledge. Mm-hmm. So that's why.
So you worked with rats
mm-hmm.
on this project.
I was working with kids in other projects.
Yes.
Too, just that particular thing.
So this was behavior modification with rats.
Mm-hmm.
And then these things, I've heard that the HDFL department, that this has been a major theme of theirs, was the behavior modification thing.
We prefer to call it behavior analysis.
I see.
Behavior modification usually means that it means to most people that you are giving candy or
rewards of some kind.
Well, and oftentimes not related to the task at hand. And it's a lot more than that. We delve into, because we're experimentally oriented, we delve into the analysis of the interaction of a person's behavior in their environment. The ongoing, the static environment as well as the active environment. And historical aspects of the person too. So we really do look at the whole person. We're not into just tossing M&Ms to kids.
I see.
And I feel very strongly about that. I'm not a behavior modifier. I am a behavior analyst.
Mm-hmm. And you were working, with retarded or learning disabled children? Was that a focus of your PhD?
Children who had some learning problems, yes. And I was also working with preschool children because as soon as I was hired by the department a year before I got my degree, I was the associate director of the Child Development Laboratory in the Department of Human Development.
Oh,
I was hired as that.
The nurseries, what they had, the nursery schools mm-hmm. at that time.
Yes, over in the old building across from the, it was an old house. It was across from the, where you play football, the stadium.
Oh, the stadium, uh-huh.
But it's since been removed.
And then, when did you get your PhD?
1970.
And this was during a very interesting time at KU then, that you were here your PhD.
Yes, there were a lot of drug problems, there were a lot of Vietnam War problems, there were a lot of different types of
hippie
problems.
Yeah, did this affect your department? Did you see students, say, in HDFL being involved in these things, or the professors?
I saw some students getting in trouble. The professors tried to help the students. There were some professors who marched on the John Wright, which marched on the football field for anti-war demonstration. Mm-hmm. Almost got himself in trouble, but he laughs about it now. But he's a good professor, too, and he was very concerned about his students. Mm-hmm. But I was here during the time when they asked us to forego all grading of students
mm-hmm.
and that kind of thing, because of the unrest and the burning of the union and we had to, on alert time, spend times in our buildings overnight on a rotation basis.
Did you do that too?
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah, so did my husband. And then after you got your PhD, what did you do?
Well, I started working as a professor in the department and as the director of the Child Development Laboratories.
Oh, uh-huh. So you just went right from there to...
I did it before I even finished my PhD.
You were already working in the... So now, instead of teaching special education people, you were teaching college students how to be preschool teachers?
Well, that and college students how to teach kids with learning problems. My emphasis has always been on trying to... My research emphasis has always been on analyzing why certain learning problems occur and looking for teaching techniques that would overcome those learning problems. Because again, I think that oftentimes children don't learn because of, it's not their fault. It's the fault of the teaching procedures that we're using. But it's not necessarily the fault of the teacher because we don't know what the right procedures are.
Uh-huh.
And so that, my major research emphasis all through the years has been on trying to find ways to help people learn, have trouble learning. It can be adults, it can be kids, it can be mild learning, it can be severe. I like the more difficult problems. I like challenges. I get bored if I don't have challenges. And so that's probably why I moved subsequently down toward the more severe level.
You were researching then, I assume, with people primarily.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
These were people from the Lawrence community?
Mainly
who were
from our preschool population.
Oh,
at that
I see.
Time.
You were working with preschool
we
children.
We accepted
then.
Children. In other words, we were integrated very early on with kids who had learning problems and with retardation, with autism. We had them in our classes.
Oh, I see. Just with the regular children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We had our own inclusion program before inclusion became a.
So do you think that this is a good idea then, evidently?
That's a loaded question. I think that all children should have an individualized education. And in order to do that, it may mean that children with retardation at certain times would be integrated with kids who move faster. But it also means that I'm not necessarily wanting those kids to sit there during a French class and not learn anything.
Yeah.
So I would prefer that they be out learning something that's going to be useful for them. I'm of the philosophy that these people can work, and it's our job to figure out a way to get them to do it. And they can become contributing members in their community.
Mm-hmm.
They may be different all their lives.
Oh, yeah.
But then I'm different. Everybody's different.
Mm-hmm.
What is a disability? If you wear glasses, you're disabled. If you stop to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
It means you don't have perfect vision.
Yeah.
You know, I have implants in my eyes at this point. Am I disabled? No. And not in what society thinks, but yes. In the truest sense of the words. It's all on a continuum. And so... these people are my friends, kids with autism and so forth. They write letters to me.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Autism seems to have been one of the more difficult of these disabilities to
cope with.
Because
we didn't catch it early enough, and we didn't know enough about it early on. I think in the next decade, we're going to see a whole different population of people with autism. But they're not going to... Well, because... First of all, we're identifying them much earlier than we used to.
Mm-hmm.
We used to could not identify them until 3-4 years of age. Now they're identifying them as early as a year, year and a half. And the infant people are working hard toward trying to figure out if they can identify them earlier. And the earlier you identify them and the sooner you get them into a specialized program that individualize, the better off they are. But you see, I think all people have learning disabilities in one way or another. I don't memorize well.
Mm-hmm.
Neither did Einstein, so I'm in good company. That's why he flunked elementary school. He was bored too. But I think everyone has specific ways of learning and specific things that will hold them back. And I think that our educational system, if it were ideal, would handle this. So that every person, and also think that education should not stop. I think we should continue. I think the public schools should be responsible for adult education and continuing education. Or the state system. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know that it has to be public schools or university, state, university, but the state systems, I think, should be responsible. Because what happens? You have adults who can't use computers, mm-hmm. but their kids can do circles around them.
Yeah.
You have kids who are living in a totally different world than their parents.
Oh, yeah.
And this is difficult. So we should keep everyone on target and learning. That's ideal.
And the people would have to want to, which some do and some don't.
Well, I think they would want to if it were presented right. See, learning doesn't have to be a chore. Learning should be fun. Mm-hmm. And if it were fun, people would want to do it. But learning should be fun, should be functional, and it should be failure proof.
Oh, really?
You should not.
Because there has certainly been controversy about that.
As much as possible. Nothing is perfectly failure proof.
Of course.
And I recognize you do have to make errors in order to be able to learn how to make errors in life. But for the most part, it shouldn't be so, you shouldn't have so much failure that it becomes a burden to you and it becomes offensive to you. It can't be fun if you have a lot of errors.
And this has always been a problem in the schoolroom, that there's a certain amount of kids who don't learn very well and feel like failures.
Don't know the techniques to teach them. Or if we do know them, we're not using them. Uh-huh.
Which is hard for one teacher with 25 to 30 kids.
I understand that. I've taught kids with 45 in my classroom.
Really?
In the military schools. Well, there were 35 in my Houston schools because they were overcrowded.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's certainly very difficult. Mm-hmm. And you were talking about autism. KU is known for its program in that, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Yes, Jim Sherman and his work with the Community Living Organization. Jim and I were co-chairs of the department for a while, for about 8 years, actually, not just for a while.
When was that?
Good question. It's probably under something like other positions. That must have been in 76 to 84.
Uh-huh. And what was going, was there anything specific that was going on in the department at that time or that you originated?
Well, Frances Horowitz was leaving. She was the one that had originated the department.
Uh-huh.
And along with the help of Dick Schieffelbusch from the Bureau of Child Research. Mm-hmm. And so then when she was going on up into administration, she wasn't leaving the university, she was going on mm-hmm. into administration, we had to vote on a new chair. And Jim Sherman and I were among the top five or so candidates, and a couple of candidates opted out. They didn't want to do it. And he could have done it by himself because he beat me out in voting, but he said he didn't want to. And so we became equal co-chairs. He asked me if I would do it with him, mm-hmm. which I did for about 8 years. And at the same time, I was still the... At that time, Barbara Etzel had gone up the hill, who was the director of the Child Development Laboratory, so I was also the director of the Child Development Laboratory for part of that time, for about half of that time.
And you were teaching classes? Or probably not while you were...
Oh, yeah. No, I was teaching full loads.
Right, you must have been very busy. What classes did you teach?
I taught a class that for undergraduates that was called Introduction to Research with Children, because I believe strongly that you have to learn by doing. What this class was designed around was to let the students have their first opportunity to work with a real life little being, mm-hmm. and under well-controlled conditions. And that's basically what we did. And their job was to teach them something that the teachers indicated they needed to learn. So this was all a part of the child laboratory system also. But it allowed the students to learn how to work with children before they moved into their the ones who were going to get their certification. It allowed them to have a little experience under very controlled conditions with kids before they went into their practicum experiences.
So you taught mostly undergraduates?
No, I taught a several graduate courses. I taught graduate courses in applied techniques. I taught graduate courses. The one that most everyone in the department remembers me for is a course in how in research, applied research, and what's involved, and how one reads the research literature critically. Because it's been my experience that undergraduates really do it, and graduates still do it, is that they believe everything they read. And they have. So in order to change that, I worked out ways for them to analyze, again in a very active environment, analyze research and critique research articles so that they could learn how to look at what was really good and what was not really good based on, you know, the traditional, what you need to do in order to have controls and things in research.
And then I believe you went on a trip to Japan.
Mm-hmm. Early on. And then I went to a second one. Actually, a friend, I worked with a professor, he was a professor, I guess, at that time, who had come over for a year sabbatical.
Oh, uh-huh.
And we called him Peter. Actually, that was his Christian name. I mean, he had Fujita as his last name, and he had a first name, a Japanese name, but he had been christened also Peter,
mm-hmm.
and because his father worked with a missionary. And so anyway, Peter came, and then he declared that he was going to bring me and Barbara Edsel to Japan within the next 5 years, which he did, so that we could go around and teach his people the things that we were teaching. University.
And this had to do with special education?
Somewhat, and also learning, just learning in general. You see, all of the special education and the learning ride together.
Mm-hmm.
And they were more interested in Japan at that time in the learning aspects of it, had what's involved when people learn and how one can analyze this.
Were they using different teaching methods than people did over here?
Quite likely, yes. They always have, actually. They're much more structured, I think, than we are.
And you were teaching them about how to learn about different ways of teaching people who had difficulties.
And also how to research which ways are better or will work for a particular individual.
Have you had publications, I suppose, then, because you've been involved in research?
Yeah. They're all in
here. Oh, a lot of. Oh, any books?
I only edited one book. I've had chapters in books, but I've never written a book. I'm in the process of doing that right now based on my work in South America. And that'll come.
Mm-hmm. Were you on departmental or university committees, I suppose?
A ton of them.
Any you particularly remember?
Well, again, they're all listed in my vita.
Okay.
One by one. So.
All right. You belong to professional organizations?
Mm-hmm. I belong to the American Psychological Association. I was a named fellow in that. And belong to the Council for Exceptional Children. National Association for Young Children, and of course the Association for Behavior Analysis. On Behavior Analysis, I was given the first award for my work in international development, and then since that time they've had an annual award. for people who promote international development.
Have you held offices in these organizations?
No, I'm not politically oriented in that sense.
Have you ever had sabbaticals?
Mm-hmm. My first sabbatical was to Europe, and we traveled Germany, Italy, England, and mainly looked at work that colleagues were doing and presented our work to them. Barbara Edsel went with me on that sabbatical.
And this was also about how people learn.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what
but
you
then,
were interested in.
However many years later, I think it's seven or so that you have to wait.
Yes.
I had my second sabbatical and I went to Latin America on that one. And that's when I first started working regularly each year down in Peru.
Oh, really? When was that about?
That was in 85, 86. 81 was my first trip to Peru because the director of the Ann Sullivan Center of Peru found me at an American Psychological Association meeting because she had come to the United States to learn more about behavior analysis because she had opened a center for all of the rejects of Lima, Peru, whose parents couldn't find educational services or even psychological services for them because people wouldn't work with them. So she had